Roger Williams University is hosting a crisis management seminar on May 3rd at their Providence campus. Crises, whether a natural disaster, cyber attack, or financial instability, can have severe repercussions if not handled properly. This is where crisis management plays a pivotal role. Join Roger Williams MBA students and expert speakers to learn how to prepare for the unexpected. The program is totally free and open to the public. You can register online at rwu.edu/events/crisis-management-symposium.
This is the Bartholomew Town Podcast.
Welcome to another edition of the Bartholomew Town Podcast. I'm your host, Bill Bartholomew. From our Providence, Rhode Island studios, I sit down with Rhode Island legend, Arlene Violet. Arlene Violet is a former nun, the former Attorney General of Rhode Island, a former talk radio host, and currently a columnist, pro bono attorney, and media personality in Rhode Island. She was the first female in the United States to be elected an Attorney General and has built a legal career defending victims' rights, ethics, and environmental causes. Our conversation touched on Ms. Violet's own life's journey, the state of global affairs, Rhode Island politics, small and large media outlets, and pursuing social justice. Okay, right before we get to my interview with Arlene Violet, I just want to let you know that the first Bartholomew Town print article has hit newsstands via Motif Magazine. Excited about this new partnership with Motif Magazine. And you can go to motifri.com, or if you're inside the Southern New England listening area, you can find the physical magazine on most newsstands. This first article is a feature on Dr. Luis Daniel Munoz, independent gubernatorial candidate here in Rhode Island, and following him around as he navigates the signature phase, which is over and done with at this point. But man, it was quite an adventure being out there with some of those independent and unendorsed candidates as they collected signatures, a whole lot of interfacing, and it's a really interesting experience, and I tried to convey Dr. Munoz's experience the best I could in this article. So I'll link to it via my Twitter. It's at Bill Bartholomew. All right, let's get right to it. Rhode Island legend Arlene Violet. All right, so we are here at the Bartholomew Town Loft in Providence, Rhode Island, with the great Rhode Island luminary, Arlene Violet.
Something
thank you so
like
much
that.
For your time.
Hi, good to see you.
Real pleasure. Thanks so much for coming out.
My pleasure.
For those outside of the listening area or whoever may not be familiar with your background, if you give us a little summary of
sure.
your life's journey.
Okay, well, I was a nun for 23 years, and during that time, I taught a bit, but I also went to law school and became a public interest lawyer representing all the little guys of right. this world. In the 80s, I ran for attorney general with the permission of my order because it was an activist kind of order. And the idea behind it was to respond to the unmet need. And in Rhode Island, we had a tremendous political corruption problem, mob problem. The Colombian drug cartel had moved up from Miami to Central Falls, Rhode Island. And, of course, victims had no rights. And at the time, I was living in all the poor neighborhoods, which means they're high victim neighborhoods. And I would see people taking buses to go to court four or five times during the course of their so-called trial where they had to be a witness. And then they'd show up one day and were told, oh, that case has been resolved without you. So further, diminishing them as human beings that they didn't even have a control over their fate right. as a victim. So for all those reasons, I ran for attorney general. My order supported me. I eventually won. But the bishop by that time under church law had the right to say yes or no, and he told me I would have to leave if I wanted to be the attorney general. So from my perspective, it was a commitment to the reality of the commitment of being a sister of mercy, respond to that unmet need, or I could have walked away from it and kept the title without the substance of being that nun.
Right. And which year was that? Which election was that?
Well, I ran in 82
right.
and lost. In 84, I won.
And that was under, so that was the Garrahy years? Where are we at?
Yeah. Just trying to... Well, Ed DePreet was DePreet, the governor
right.
when
okay,
I
sure.
got elected.
Yep. Okay, yes. And you served two terms?
One.
One term.
Yes.
Then, at which point did you become a talk radio personality?
Shortly after that, I started. Right. I had a house in West Warwick where I lived, and there was a radio station on the way by, and the man I loved who ran that station asked me if I would do drive time. So on my way home, I started 5 to 6, and then eventually Buddy Cianci, who was on WHJJ at the time, decided to return to politics. So back in 1990, I got that job and commenced doing that through all of 1916. That's what I feel like, 1916, but to 2006, yeah.
2006, what a run.
Yeah, it was. I loved it. All the people that would go to RISD, for example, if they were having a special artist come or a speaker at Brown, all stop by, so I get to interview a lot of people nationally, internationally, and of course talking about local issues was very important to me.
Plus the relationship you had with your listeners, I'm sure that some listeners are still in touch with you today, you know?
Yeah, it was really nice because I think it's important to air all sides of an issue. Sometimes I wouldn't even say what my opinion was until the very end of the talk show because people should really respect and listen, particularly to people who have opposite points of view. But that's a rarity these days. People now tend to only listen to the news stations that already support the position that they're in.
Right, the narrow casting.
Yeah.
We've really tried to have candidates or people from all different perspectives on this program.
Fabulous.
Is something that's important to me for sure. And I'm surprised by how much a lot of people will say from either side of the spectrum, oh, I can't believe you had person X on. He's he's totally out of bounds in what he says.
Well, that's exactly what you are to hear, because how can you live in this society without knowing the full panoply of people's thoughts on issues?
Absolutely. Do you miss talk radio now? Is it something you do again?
I don't really, because fortunately I get to write a weekly column for two of the little local newspaper groups.
Right.
One of which is called Politics.
The Valley Breeze, one of an outstanding newspaper.
It really is, right. And East Bay, Rhode Island, has papers in six or seven jurisdictions in Rhode Island as well, and they carry my column as well. So at least I get to vent by writing that column.
And that column's run for how long now?
At least a decade, if not longer.
It's a great column. What's it like working in these sort of, you can't really say small town, but regional, I guess, with the hyper-regional newspapers, particularly with the Valley Breeze, a paper I'm fascinated by in terms of its content and how well it covers that region.
Tom Ward's a great publisher. As you know, those are the papers that are being successful.
Right.
They're expanding while, regrettably, the Providence Journal is contracting. Providence Journal is a great work product, too, though.
Sure.
Do fabulous stories. I love newspapers, so it breaks my heart when I see reporters having to be laid off or leaving
or
from
bought
the paper.
Out as the new the recent stories are right.
But I think certainly we're a newspaper town because there's so much to be reporting all the time. You know, I was writing this morning my column for next week because I have to have it in a week ahead of time, and it's sort of like a kudos and a brickbats kind of column. So on the one hand, I'm praising General Treasurer Magaziner for sponsoring legislation that would make Catholic religious groups open up the truth about their pension plans, because the Diocese of Providence did not do that, and now the nurses that were at St. Joseph's and Fatima Hospital and the orderlies and the bakers, you know, their pensions are all in jeopardy, right? So that's a good thing that he's doing. But on the other hand, we have a politician like Greg Achato running to get his own Senate seat. He's been convicted of several crimes. He seems to get things expunged that shouldn't be expunged. And so I was just doing the contrast that any day you wake up in Rhode Island, there's a good thing happening and a certainly not so good thing happening.
Right. As Buddy Cianci said, full contact sport up here.
Yes, you know? It is.
Absolutely.
Of course, people like him make it a full contact sport.
No question about it. Well, let's get right into that pension issue. That's something that you've been vocal about. I've seen, heard, and read you on this issue, and something you obviously are passionate about. Yeah. I personally can't understand how anybody who observes the facts here can have any opinion that differs from yours, which is that this is an outrage. But what's it like for you being sort of a spokesperson through the media, if you will.
Well, you know, here you and I are here at your loft, right?
Right.
And it's a stone's throw away, St. Joseph's Hospital. I remember when I was a young nun, picketing with those nurses who were trying to start a union back then.
Yeah.
And of course, I stood out because I was the only one in the black habit among all the white uniforms that were picketing around the building. So for me, it's something that's come full circle. But it's also very discouraging because I was a nun for 23 years, and it's so discouraging to me to see how unjust the Catholic Church is in this situation. I mean, for example, these nurses worked for far less money as part of seeing it as their vocation to even earn less in a Catholic hospital. They were promised this pension. When Bishop Tobin got here 10 years ago, he gradually stopped giving the necessary contributions in that pension. Meanwhile, mailings would go out saying everything was copacetic with that pension until last August. The diocese had the pension filed into receivership and saying everybody should be cut 40% right away. Now, we've managed, I represent pro bono all the older people ages 75 to 99 years of age who get an average pension of $750 a month, no cost of living increases.
Wow.
And there's no way that you can cut them 40%. And Bill, the other part of it is, you know, the nurses, they were making a dollar an hour, so their Social Security check is de minimis as well. So here are people who've worked 40 years of their lives, 45 years, and they're really faced with potentially going on welfare at the end of their lives, which is such an insult to them. So it's very discouraging to me that the diocese put them in this situation. And of course, I'll fight tooth and main to try to avoid this catastrophe from happening to these people.
What's a way out at this point for the diocese?
Well, it certainly has property, and one of the counts, which is a federal lawsuit and a state court suit, and much to the credit of Max Wistow, who's the lead lawyer in this litigation, he's alleged fraudulent conveyance, which means that he sold those hospitals off to an entity knowing that the pensions would be hurt. And he did it anyway. And also that they colluded together with the people buying these hospitals not to fund the pensions with some of the proceeds from that. So if we prove fraudulent conveyance, the nurses will end up, and my clients, the bakers and the candlestick makers, right, they'll end up owning those hospitals, which we can then sell to put the money back into the pension. So that's the strongest argument that we have to totally recoup.
Wow. Well, I would like personally to continue to keep tabs on that. And hopefully we can highlight it more on this podcast. It's rare that I like to come out and take a position on an issue, but this is absolutely unjust.
Yeah. I know.
There's
it's
no
awful,
question.
Too, is a pension, you know, that may be happening now to the teachers that are in the Catholic school system and all the janitors and all the people who work for the diocese. That hasn't been officially announced, but it'll be a darn shame if they take a hit like this as well. There's no reason for it. You know, it's an issue of priorities.
Right.
The priorities of this bishop have been totally off base as far as I'm concerned.
Let's turn to Rhode Island politics, if we may. Something that, the gubernatorial race in particular it's underway. It feels like, you know, we're past the signature phase now. Nomination papers are turned in. It looks like we know who's actually going to be running. As far as, let's start with the fringe candidates. Is there anyone, I'll go ahead and call Joe Trillo a fringe candidate, but if you look at him or Dr. Munoz, is there anyone who, even Matt Brown potentially could be considered a fringe candidate, anyone who can mount a challenge to just be in that front runner position that right now Mayor Fung and Governor Raimondo are in?
Well, I love that you said, you know, it's just beginning, because for me it seems like it's been going on forever
already.
It's only July, but I digress. Anything can happen in a race. I know certainly the present governor is well-funded. She has a story to tell about accomplishments, but, you know, there's also some negative things, particularly the UHIP. As you know, people who are lower income tend to be Democrats, but yet they're the people that are being hurt by the UHIP's situation. So whether they'll even show up to vote is a big question mark in my mind. I also feel that, you know, anybody can win this race. I really feel that way. What the progressives do relative to supporting Matt Brown, I think, is an open question. You mentioned Dr. Munoz a moment ago, and obviously he doesn't have the finances, in my view at least to mount a campaign that is a winning campaign. But he's one of the most creative thinkers in this race, for heaven's sakes, you know. And he's a fine candidate, except without money, which is the milk, I guess, of politics, he's not going to be able to get his messages across.
Right. What about the lieutenant gubernatorial race? This photo I woke up to on Sunday morning. I don't know if you saw the tweet from Ian Donis of Lieutenant Governor McKee alongside Michael Earnhardt at a barbecue in on the east side of Providence. The photo evidently came from someone indirectly related to the Regenberg camp, trying to paint the picture that McKee is a, you know, essentially a closet conservative. That race, to me, actually has the most juice right now and is the most
volatile. I think you're right. I think that is an extremely volatile race. As you know, the progressives, part of the Democrat Party, they think that they're in this to win back the heart and soul of what the Democratic Party is supposed to be. And just like the Sanders voters were very highly motivated, I think the progressives would crawl out of bed in a snowstorm, hooked up to IVs to go vote. You know, that's how motivated they are. And I think that makes that an extremely close race.
And do you think that'll influence in a Democratic primary the gubernatorial race or potentially the Senate race with Patricia Fonce now challenging Senator Whitehouse from the left?
Yes. Again, he has such an extraordinary amount of money. I'm not sure you can overcome that advantage. But Regenberg certainly has enough money himself to give Dan McGee a run for the money, literally. And I think that's the race. Whether it has repercussions is an excellent question that you ask, because, as you know, it's who shows up and votes.
Right.
Right. And to the degree that people who tend to be Democrat are being harmed by the UHIP situation, that's not a motivation for them to show up. But
absolutely,
the progressives, they're going to show up, I think, for Mr. Regenberg.
In terms of just in general, the Rhode Island Republican Party, where it's at today, it seems to be trying to find itself. We had Judge Flanders on here, and he was very vocal in saying that he is not Trumpian, you know what I mean? Really trying to position himself somewhere closer to a moderate, so to speak. At the same time, you hear comments coming from other candidates for governor that seem quite Trumpian. Where's the Republican Party living?
First of all, the local Republican Party, I think, is a completely different beast than the national party. And it still has its roots, I think, in being the opposition party. Yeah, in many ways. I mean, when you think about it, I ran as a Republican and won as a Republican Attorney General. Back in those days, we had the Lila Sappinsleys, you know, the first
Chafee
head, right?
Yep.
Claudine Schneider, first Congresswoman, Suzanne Farmer, Barbara Leonard. It was the Republican Party that supported women to run as candidates, whereas the Democrats did not, in fact, do that. So in many ways, the Republicans were more Democratic, in a way, than certainly the Democrats were. So I think there is an identity crisis, in a way, in the Republican Party today, because far too many Republicans, I think, feel that they have to embrace Donald Trump. I'm glad that Flanders does not, because I think it would be a death wish. And I think the problem for Flanders in his race is people that think he's a good candidate, and he is a moderate. But you're going to have to say to yourself, do I want to send somebody there to keep a Republican majority?
Right.
And, you know, I have always voted both Republican and Democrat through my entire life. But, I mean, it's even a question for me what I'm going to do, because I'm so discouraged, frankly, at Mr. Trump's anti-immigrant stances and the fact that he has a whole following of people who, in my view, are adopting his anti-American stances. Rhode Island is very interesting. This is perhaps the most Catholic state. We're taught every Sunday, you know, from the pulpit, respect other human beings. We are all equal. And yet we see the progression of languages that is used by Donald Trump. They're murderers and rapists, you know, those mothers with the little children, and then, you know, they're lawbreakers. Then they become animals, and then he called them vermin. And when you hear that kind of language, that's exactly what the fascists did to the Jews. You know, that Jew's going to take your job. I mean, that's the same anti-rhetoric against immigrants today. The Armenian Holocaust occurred using exactly that demonization. Make people look like they're less than human. And it really bothers me to no end that this is what is happening in this country today. We're becoming more anti-American than ever.
Yeah, it's unbelievable, actually. I was actually had a conversation with my mom this morning. She just moved from Rhode Island to New Hampshire. And just talking about how everywhere you go within New England, you know, you never know which pocket is going to be exposed to have a large percentage of people who have adopted those views, including in Rhode Island. There's no question about it.
His population, Mr. Trump's popularity went up. Right. Following his comments. It really is discouraging to me. I maybe it's because I'm getting old, and maybe when you get older, you get to worry about what's happening, is what's going to happen to the country that you love. But we don't speak with each other anymore. We don't interact, and we name call. You know, once you hear name calling, discussion's all over. And regrettably, Donald Trump, through his name-calling, I think has really created a terrible, terrible direction for this country. You know, address the issue. Certainly we need immigration reform, but address it. Don't call people vermin because you don't know what you're doing.
Right. Yeah, and I hope Rhode Islanders can embrace the idea of being truly independent and during this election have conversations between a Matt Brown, a Gina Raimondo, a Dr. Munoz, a Giovanni Feroci, an Alan Fung, and you know, go ahead and throw Bill Gilbert's voice into that if you want to, whatever it may be, and actually have a mature conversation. It seems like it's slipped quite a bit in recent days, especially with the Carpionato group fiasco and some other things. Trillo's boat. Yeah. The SS Trillo crashing. It's gotten a little off topic, but my hope is that in light of the fact that things have gotten so dark at the federal level, maybe we could step up in Rhode Island and actually have an election based on fact and discussion rather than name calling.
You know, earlier in our conversation, we talked about the fact that anything that can happen in a campaign and change the result. I mean, didn't we see that with Clay Pell when he couldn't find the car?
Right.
And then the hockey stick, Bobby Orr's hockey stick was broken. And then I never understood why his campaign didn't come out right away, because, you know, when you get paid off for a stolen car, it then belongs to the insurance company. And people were killing Clay Pell, that his car was still in storage. Look at all the money he's wasting on storage. Well, that was the insurance company keeping it there.
Right.
They had already paid him off. He was long gone out of the picture. But the campaign never explains that, and it brings down a candidate.
Absolutely.
And anything like that, you know, whether it's a boat or something else, anything can derail.
Although there was quite a bit of argument on a lively experiment this past week that Trillo's popularity actually went up because of the boat crashing, his name recognition, and his brand kind of translates to some kind of silliness, so that works for him. You know?
Well, it's, and I think certainly with some people, his connection to Donald Trump works for him.
Absolutely. There's no question about it. I was at PVD Fest, and, you know, there were some politicians around. I think even Mayor Lorza went by in a bicycle or something like that. But nothing compared to the moment that Joe Trillo's bus pulled into the Kennedy Plaza and just there it was. It was like Trump landing his airplane in these remote towns in Oklahoma. The specter of this guy.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
And he's a good debater.
Quite a good debater. Absolutely. As far as right now, the way media is shaped, you're on the board of directors for the Hummel Report.
I'm chair.
Chair of the board. Yeah. And where are we heading as we see newspapers shrinking, television revenues shrinking, radio stations closing, personalities being paid less and less, or more sponsor-based salaries? It's in some ways it feels like the industry is collapsing, yet at the same time we have the Hummel Report and we have these independent media outlets that are doing a great job. You even have someone like a Steve Alquist out there who's putting together daily great work. So where is it heading, and how does it survive?
I'm very concerned, obviously, about the direction for a couple of reasons. First, calling the media the enemy of the people is a really terrible thing. I mean, I think certainly the president is setting up his excuse relative to what may or may not come out with Russiagate. So that's one thing. And the media itself has sacrificed itself. in this regard that, you know, I remember, you know, Joe Friday, cop, you know, in the old days, just the facts, ma'am, just
right,
the
Joe
facts.
Friday on PBS
Dragnet. And media is supposed to do that. You know, what are the facts? Unless you're writing an opinion piece. My column's an opinion piece.
Yep.
I put it out there and, you know, people can at least respond back. But when you pass news off like it's the ultimate fact, I mean, and it's really your opinion, it really destroys the integrity of the fact-finding process. So I'm very worried, too. The media is taking a rap and should take a rap for its personalization and opinionating of facts. And that's not a good direction we're going in.
Right. How do we get out of that? What's the move? Because advertising is the traditional way of funding media. Is it looking towards grants and things, organizations, nonprofits to actually support the media the way like artists survive now?
Well, that's going to be part of the solution, Bill. I think you're right about that. But we need giants in the industry to come forward and reiterate what a news media is supposed to be. And, you know, I don't think there should be like an MSNBC that's liberal and then, you know, Fox on the other side. I don't like that. They both ought to be striving for the integrity of the story.
Right.
So I'm not a fan of opposition stations because they're passing opinions off as fact.
With respect to, I guess, just the tone of or the feel, we've got about 300. Secretary of State Nellie Gurbia told me about 300,000 people vote of 700,000 registered voters. Mm-hmm. What do you think it would take to motivate more people to vote? Or maybe not registered voters, 700,000, 700,000 potential voters that could register. What does it take to increase voter interest in Rhode Island?
Well, I sure wish theoretically it would be done because it's the patriotic thing to do. However, that's a dream. That, in fact, I have. The simple fact is people do not go out to vote unless it's in their self-interest. So if it's something that they have that they think is going to be relegated to an endangered species list, that's the thing that gets them out to vote. I really don't see that changing.
Right. Yeah, that's frustrating.
But it is frustrating.
It's definitely,
yes.
It's definitely true. All right, last question. We're about to hit primary season full swing here, kind of looping back to the discussion of Rhode Island politics. Do you think we should move the primary to an earlier time in the year?
I certainly do. You really don't have any time to formulate cogent issues and discussions because they're just really virtually back-to-back 6 or 7 week differentiation. So I think it's wrong that it's September, November. Definitely move it back.
Move it all
spring.
The way to June?
I would move it to late spring. Absolutely.
Maybe how would you persuade the General Assembly to make that happen?
I unsuccessfully because it's so dominated by Democrats, right? Where it's working for them the way it is. So they're never going to change something that gives them the upper hand.
Right. Yeah. Hummel actually, you know, jokingly said maybe they'd actually get something done in March or April if, which is true. Wait, think of it, you know, for sure. It's kind of shocking the calendar, the way it works out here. No question about it.
I'm with you. I'm with Jim on that.
Any final words for our audience here?
Well, just I'm so happy that they're listening to you. You have really good guests on, and I'm going to be a devotee myself. So congratulations to you and continue good success.
Thank you so much. It means a lot to have you on here. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure again.
Hey, thanks for listening. Remember, you can subscribe, rate, and review us on Apple Podcasts or your favorite listening platform. You may find us at BartholomewTown.com or RIPodcast.com. And be on the lookout for Bartholomew Town print articles in Motif Magazine. Until next time, thanks for visiting Bartholomew Town. We'll talk soon.
At HealthSource RI for Employers, we provide access to health insurance to more than 1,100 local businesses and nonprofits, and 96% of them renew through us every year. Maybe it's our choice of 19 different health plans, our 10 years of customizing solutions, or our one local team of dedicated experts helping employers find quality health insurance. see how our numbers stack up for you. Learn more at healthsourceri.com/employers.